I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now from Denver.
Ice water. Anyone need ice water?
We do. El Jalapeno Cheddar Brats, Southwest Buffalo Brats, reindeer sausages imported from Alaska, wild boar sausages.
Ma'am, how you doing today? Would you like a shirt or a button, a nice souvenir today?
I see delegates and people with lapel pins, and I say, can I have that button? Can I trade you, please?
You know, the Ale to the Chief is a beer brewed by Avery Brewing Company, Adam Avery, out in Boulder, Colorado. This is a very liberally hopped beer for everybody to enjoy here in Denver, Colorado.
Ale to the Chief, the beer, is reportedly a big seller here. We would not know. Sounds from the streets of Denver. In the back rooms, the talk is still about the Clintons. Bill Clinton, of course, giving a much-anticipated speech tonight, reportedly unvetted by the Obama campaign. Hillary Clinton, of course, spoke last night, and as Maureen Dowd writes in the New York Times today, she set off paranoia among the Democrats that they might have chosen the wrong nominee or the wrong VP. Republican political mastermind Karl Rove said Clinton's speech last night was a success, but of course, the Republicans have suddenly become Hillary Clinton's biggest fans. After the Clinton speech, we spoke with an emotional and disappointed Carol Williams, a Clinton delegate from Montana. You remember, we've been following her this week.
It would have been, I think, wonderful had she been here tonight accepting our nomination, but she went a huge step forward in healing up this party. And I'm going to be wearing an Obama-Hillary button tomorrow.
Well, joining us here at Radio Row, Greg Moore, editor of the Denver Post. Greg, welcome back. And what are you hearing about reaction to the speech?
Well, I think the delegates were very, very pleased. She was forceful. You know, she laid out the agenda. And I spoke with Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, and he said she did great. She asked the right questions and answered them the right way.
Well, but there's criticism that maybe she didn't go far enough in boosting Barack Obama in, for instance, discounting what she'd said in the past that he's not ready for office.
I just don't think that was the appropriate place to do it. And I thought, and a number of people thought, that she did what she had to do, and she did it with some enthusiasm.
Well, it was enough for Carol from Montana, who said, okay, yeah, I'll go along. But maybe not enough for others. We want to hear Texas Delegate Ann Price Mills. She spoke to CNN last night after Senator Clinton's speech, also very emotional. Let's listen.
You know that was a presidential speech. She did everything for Obama that she was supposed to do. Now it's time for him to step up and do what he's supposed to do.
Will you vote for her when you cast your vote later in the week?
I was elected to come here as a delegate for Clinton. I will vote for Clinton. Now you asked me about my personal vote in November. Obama has 2 months. I won't vote for McCain. But he has to get me there.
A delegate saying it's Obama's job in the next 2 months to get me there.
Yeah, I think he still has to close the deal, as they say. And this is going to be a huge speech for him tomorrow night. And tonight is actually a huge moment for Biden following Hillary.
Right. Some are saying he better get a bright orange pantsuit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. At least come out holding a pantsuit.
Yeah, because, there's some wondering. Well, what I've been hearing from people maybe who even weren't Clinton supporters haven't even been paying attention until now. Mm-hmm. They look up and they've been hearing, oh, she lost, she didn't do well, he's the nominee. They look up and they think, that's not good enough. That was so good last night. That's not good enough. And some women in particular saying, if that's not good enough, how can I succeed in life?
I think there's the good enough question applies both to Hillary and Barack Obama. I mean, Barack Obama has opened up this convention to the Clintons. They have prime speaking opportunities. Some of their issues are reflected in a platform. And there are other people saying, what else does Barack have to do? Just as there are some saying, what else does Hillary have to do?
Well, let's talk about the voting tonight, because the delegate we heard from said tonight she's going to cast her delegate vote for Clinton and then see if she'll vote for Obama.
Right.
But we're trying to figure out what's happening.
I think it's very difficult to figure out what's happening.
With the roll call.
There's been a series of negotiations that have been ongoing for several weeks now. I do think there's a huge effort underway to try to prevent a roll call, which could, you know, expose divisions. They both won 18 million plus votes. You could easily see a 50-50 split there, and I don't think they want to see that on national television.
Well, we just moments ago spoke on our cell phones to Jim Roosevelt, who's the head of the DNC Credentials Committee.
Right.
He said what is happening as we speak in the Massachusetts delegation, which he's all he can speak directly for,
sure.
But he said they are taking their votes right now. He says the DNC is allowing the states to cast their votes starting now at breakfast and in the offices, but then in a compromise, so it wouldn't be read as if they were trying to hide the Clinton votes. If someone wants to cast their vote to their, you know, their state chair on the floor at 5 before the roll call, they still can.
I think that's a scenario. What we've heard, and again, we don't know exactly what's going on, is the state delegations are voting at breakfast. What one plan is to have the New York delegation and the Illinois delegation called on to report their vote on the floor tonight.
Just those two, though? Is
just
that what you're hearing?
That's what we're hearing.
Because Jim Roosevelt tells us that the states will then have to deliver the breakdown of the vote. They can't just say, Massachusetts went for Obama or Clinton. They have to say how many votes were in each. And he says they have to deliver those, but you're saying it might not be publicly.
I think the effort is to try to avoid a state-by-state roll call that would, reveal that 50-50 split. And so they would call on those two delegations and then by acclamation move on and endorse Barack Obama without doing a 50-state roll call.
Okay.
That's what they want.
Greg Moore, editor of the Denver Post. You're going to stay with us over the half hour, but one thing I wanted to ask you quickly. We heard Al Gore was supposed to be part of the convention. So far, we haven't seen him.
He has not been seen. Maybe he's backstage and they'll bring him out like the Wizard of Oz. But I think he's going to be speaking on behalf of Obama. That's what I've heard.
Okay. Greg Moore, you just stay right there.
I won't move.
We want to speak to you over the course of the next half hour. Well, we welcome our next guest who's with us today, and he is well known to many of you because we're going to be talking about faith right now for the first time ever. The DNC has a faith caucus. Two faith caucus panel discussions will take place tomorrow. The first two were yesterday. In fact, some are calling this the Democratic National Revival. We went to the Faith in Action panel yesterday and met a minister. She's not convinced this is the right direction for the party, but we also met a rabbi. He's glad the Democrats are not ceding religion to the Republican style.
But to their credit, instead of saying, let's imitate it and compete, they said instead, let's see what's right here and let's get it right.
If you start getting faith identified with the give and take and everyday process of politics, you are going to falsify what you're doing in politics and you're going to make a mockery of your faith. So don't go there, because we just had 8 years of the Bush White House making a mockery of faith. And I really don't think we want to repeat that.
So a little tension on the issue of faith here in Denver. Polls after the 2004 election revealed that only 1 in 4 voters consider Democrats friendly towards religion. But as we just heard, some in the party feel that it's not that. It's just that they really want to have a firewall between faith and politics. Well, the Reverend Jim Wallace, a self-described progressive evangelical, also author of the New York Times bestseller, The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith and Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. He's also founder of the Progressive Christian Network, Sojourners. He joins us now. He moderated the two Faith Caucus panels discussions earlier this week. Jim, first of all, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be back.
Oops, I should say Reverend Wallace. Welcome.
Jim is just fine.
Here and Now. So you've heard this tension.
Uh-huh.
You know, what is the thinking on the part of the party in having this caucus and really, you know, getting out there on faith?
Well, at this Democratic convention, faith is cool. 2004, it was pretty marginal. And the perception was that God was only at Republican conventions and Democrats were secular party and hostile to faith. That was never really entirely true, but that was the media caricature. But clearly, people of faith are all over this convention. An AP story this morning has a great headline. It said, people of faith challenge Democrats. They were at that same panel. And I was stressing yesterday that God is not a Republican or a Democrat. And religion has been used and abused by politics for a long time, and the religious right has been a part of that. So we've got this differently. We've got to say that we've got to challenge both sides here and hold people accountable.
Well, it's the when religion is abused that concerns many Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And we
sure.
heard from them that were listeners after we had Pastor Joel Hunter on our program last week. He's an evangelical Christian Republican who was asked to advise Democrats on their abortion plank. And he'll also offer the closing prayer to the convention. We heard from outraged Democrats asking, what's the Democratic Party doing calling in an anti-choice, anti-birth control, which they say, you know, if you want to avoid abortions, that's one way. They felt it was sort of like a Trojan horse, if you will. And they're very worried about the slippery slope of Democrats reaching out to people who are anti-choice in particular.
Well, I understand their concern, but I think it's misplaced, because what we've got to do, we've got to have a deeper and broader conversation. The media is focusing on the religious outreach. Barack Obama is a committed Christian. This is natural for him and so on. The real issue is the sea change in the agenda, because last time, 2004, if I were to ask any of your colleagues in the newsroom what the religious issues are, they would have said abortion and gay marriage. End of story. Mm-hmm. This time, the religious issues include poverty and climate change and the environment and all the rest.
Well, should say that's what a progressive evangelical defines themselves as. That's what you define as evangelical.
Right. But I also was very involved at the behest of the party in the platform conversation. I was on the phone for weeks, every day, about two places. The poverty language is stronger because of the input of faith communities here. A platform calls for cutting domestic poverty in half in 10 years. That's strong and that's new. And implementing the Millennium Development Goals. But they asked me too about abortion. And what I said was, we got to move to some new common ground here. Abortion reduction could be a good common ground for pro-life and pro-choice forces here. Because we've got to get past this old polarization. In that meeting yesterday, you know, there was some people came to shout. They came to shout about abortion. And I said, I was moderating, I'm tired of all the shouting about this. Let's talk about supporting low-income women in practical ways, preventing unwanted pregnancies, and trying to reduce the abortion rate without taking away a woman's right to choose.
Right.
So I think both sides have to down the shrill a bit and talk about some common ground.
Greg Moore of the Denver Post, you were nodding your head yes. I mean, this is, we also heard from listeners who said, you know, frankly, I'm a Democrat and I would like to see less abortions, fewer abortions. It doesn't mean I'm anti-choice.
Right. We have a Democratic governor here who is pro-life. And a number of Democrats are starting to say that we have to make the tent big enough for both. And I was shaking my head because I had not heard the term abortion reduction, but that sounds like what these politicians are talking about.
And that is the new third plank and the new language, which says, the second part of the plank is about pregnancy prevention, and the third is about programs for women who may have a child if they felt they had some help.
You know, I had a woman come to me at a book table in California. She said, my daughter's graduating from Harvard this year. I'm so proud. I teach her part-time. I thought that's why she was telling me. And I said, that's great. She says, but I almost aborted my child because when I was pregnant, I was poor. And if I didn't have food stamps and Medicaid, I would have aborted my child. She's graduated from Harvard. Tell people my story, she said. Tell them my story.
Well, you just did. That's the Reverend Jim Wallace. We're also speaking with Greg Moore of the Denver Post. As rehearsals begin for tonight's convention, we're going to take a quick break, just 1 minute, and we will be... Oh, actually, no, we're listening to music from the first ever revival meeting. Interfaith service last Sunday here at the Democratic Convention. We'll leave you with that. Be back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now in Denver. We're back with more of our conversation about faith and politics. A poll by the Pew Forum on Religion and the Public found that half of those who attend weekly church services identify themselves as conservative. Less than a quarter call themselves liberal. Will Democrats be able to take advantage of those who are liberal and a church attending? Is there such a thing as the religious left? We're talking with progressive evangelical Reverend Jim Wallace, author of The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith and Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. We're also joined here at the Pepsi Center in Denver by Greg Moore of the Denver Post. And I want to just lean more towards politics than faith, Reverend, for just a second, because we've been trying to figure out how the roll call is going to go tonight. Some were saying that perhaps the Democratic Party didn't want to see as much of the Hillary Clinton votes on the floor. But we have heard again from Jim Roosevelt, who again is with the Credentials Committee, who's kind enough to take a quick call. And he said there will be a roll call. The states will announce their tally. And not maybe not just two states, as, okay. as you heard, okay. All the states until they get Obama over the top. He says Alabama may yield the floor to Florida and Michigan to let them go first
right.
because of that kerfuffle. But otherwise, the roll call will okay. go on. So okay. there we have that. That, that news from directly from Jim Roosevelt.
That's from the horse's mouth.
So to speak. Reverend Jim Wallace, we've been talking about the new push by the Democrats to make faith a part of the conversation. And I'm wondering, is it working? Are you seeing an emergence of what some are calling the religious left?
Well, I think it's important to remember that left and right are political categories and not religious categories. Mm. And religion doesn't squeeze naturally into those. But I want to say there are millions of votes in play at stake in this election. Who will be listening to whoever speaks a moral language? I said moral, not religious language of politics. And who speak to those issues? Climate change is a religious issue now for a new generation of young evangelicals. Poverty, HIV/AIDS, the war in Iraq, sanctity of life, but yes, not just folks on abortion, but the 30,000 kids who died yesterday of stupid poverty and preventable disease. That's a life issue, too. So I think this could shift the ground of faith in politics, and that's a good thing because, you know, Dr. King never endorsed a candidate, but he made politicians endorse the agenda of a movement. I'm speaking at both conventions on the same questions, trying to push both sides. Wouldn't it be great if fighting poverty was a nonpartisan issue and a bipartisan cause, and even abortion reduction could stop the shouting and get people together to actually do something to support low-income women, not coerce, but support women in making either choice right. and give them the freedom to make both choices.
People on the left are fond of saying no one is for abortion. If anything, we are for choice. But, Greg, again, I'm seeing you nod your head from the Denver Post there, and your paper writes that maybe it's not a religious left. Maybe that's a bad phrase to your ear, Reverend, but this emergence of more voices in the debate mm-hmm. signals that there is a pendulum swing from right to left and that younger evangelicals think their elders made a mistake in sticking so closely with the Republican agenda.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think from the Democratic standpoint, they want to be able to reclaim some people who've been chased out of the Democratic Party because of issues like abortion, where their voices and their views just were not welcome. And I think in order to enlarge that tent, politicians like Barack Obama and other Democrats, Bill Ritter, are saying there's room for debate within the Democratic House, mm-hmm. and they want to embrace that other view.
Reverend, I want to ask you something else about the man who's going to be nominated tonight. As you said, he has deep Christian faith. But a lot of Americans don't believe that. I stood on a running board of a huge truck at a truck stop across from where we're staying out in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, to talk to a trucker who was a huge Hillary fan, is very disappointed, and cannot accept Barack Obama because, as he said to me, well, you know, he says he's a Christian, but he's not. I said, well, why would you say that? Do you think he's been faking going to church for a couple of decades? Why? He said, nope, he's not. It's not true.
Mm-hmm.
How do you...
Well, Keith Ellison is a Muslim member of Congress and a friend of mine. There's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. But,
well,
but,
and Barack Obama walks that fine line. How, yeah, he can't protest too much.
I've had a 10-year conversation with Barack about faith. He's a committed Christian. He walked down the aisle. He had a conversion. He gave his life to Jesus. I mean, all of that. But 12% of the American people still think he's a Muslim. This is part of this. This is a whole kind of innuendo that's aimed at Barack Obama. And it's about race. It's about culture. It's about diversity. And it's part of the kind of the narrative that is in the blogosphere out there. And it's a lie. It's a lie. And he would say there's nothing wrong with being Muslim, but he's not. He's a Christian. In fact,
some would say, isn't this the problem when you put religion on the table?
Yeah, but see, I want to say, and he would say, that, you know, there should be no religious litmus test for politics. We care about what someone's moral compass is more than what their denomination or their doctrine is. It just, there's been, though, this idea that God's only on one side of the aisle. So I think it's good we have a leveling of the playing field going on so that people of faith can be on all sides of the spectrum. And you don't vote for somebody because they're a Jew and you're a Jew, they're a Baptist, you're a Baptist. You should look at their moral compass, whether they're religious or not. Barack happens to be. a Christian. He shouldn't have to be to run for office or be a Democrat. But that he is shouldn't be taken away. It's part of his biography, part of what shapes his moral compass, and that's fine.
Well, and Greg, we have about 45 seconds left. You commented on what Biden has to say tonight, in your opinion. Just briefly, what do you think Barack Obama has to do tomorrow night, maybe even for that guy in the truck?
I think Barack Obama has to come out swinging tomorrow night. I think he has to make the case that his agenda is better than John McCain's, without calling names, but really begin to sketch for these Democrats who John McCain is and why he can beat him.
And, Reverend, I'm sure you'd say whatever he does, he needs to do it in a civil, moral way.
Yeah, but I think he's got to speak his passion. His passion's strong. It's okay to let the passion flow tomorrow night.
Progressive evangelical, the Reverend Jim Wallace, author of the bestseller The Great Awakening, also with Sojourner. Thank you, as always, Reverend. Greg Moore, Denver Post, we always appreciate
my
having
pleasure.
Your insight. Thank you. Okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to go to the news when we come back. Much more here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If last night was Hillary Clinton's night to say farewell, at least as a candidate, at least this time, tonight is Joe Biden's night to reintroduce himself to America again. Biden is a two-time presidential candidate, a six-term senator from Delaware, and a deeply committed Catholic. The DNC hopes that he will bring foreign policy heft and working-class credibility to the Obama campaign. The two men got to know and respect each other while working together on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Well, Gail Chadwick is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, but today she's here in Denver with us. In fact, in our working spaces, we're slammed right up against each other in another building. So, Gail, nice to see you as always. And you wrote a piece last year, and you said, forget all you think you know about Biden, that he's a policy wonk who's been around too long and doesn't know when to stop talking. You say he's a master storyteller with real stories to tell. So tell us the cufflink story.
The cufflink story. He's in eighth grade going to a dance and discovers he doesn't have cufflinks. His mother runs to the basement, comes up with a set of nuts and bolts and starts to put them on these French cuffs. And he said, "You know, Mom, I can't. I mean, the kids are going to make fun of me." And she said, just do it. Don't worry about it. So he goes to the dance. And sure enough, kids make fun of him, nuts and bolts. And he says, "What? You don't have a pair of these?" And the cufflinks kind of became, a symbol of his grace under pressure and his absolute pride in his roots.
And it was his mom who said to him, "You look them in the eye and say that.
That's
you
right.
know, you know
look
everybody
the
has
eye.
These." Well, that's going to work well out on the stump. But what
in
about?
In fact, if you might notice, he still wears those cufflinks, although they've been reset in sterling Tiffany cufflinks his wife gave him.
Really?
Yeah. No. No.
Well, but okay. What about in the that's in the pro column perhaps? But what about in the con? It's said that part of his profile is that he has recurrent setback, but then recovery. Let's go to probably what's the least important on the list, given what the list holds. He plagiarized, and he admits it.
He did, but are you a plagiarist if you cite with attribution 40 times and without once?
So maybe he goes overboard in apologizing for that, in fact.
Well, I talked to him a lot about that. I mean, he said that he probably should have, immediately after the event said, "Look, mistake. I should have said this," mm-hmm. but he didn't.
Well, and then, of course, there's the personal story of losing half of his first family in a terrible car accident.
That's right.
His wife and a child.
Well, it shaped him in a lot of ways. This was, he had won a surprise victory to the U.S. Senate. Just before he was to take office, his wife and his daughter are killed in a car crash. He goes down to Washington.
His two sons seriously injured. He's not there, yeah.
That's right. He goes to Washington. He says, "Look, I don't want to do this job." And the majority leader at the time convinced him to just give it a try, come a few months. And he told his two boys, "Look, I will be home with you every night. You can call me on the phone anytime." And that set up a lifetime pattern of really being in Washington but not of it. He takes Amtrak home to Delaware every night of the year.
Now, the Republicans have already had a lot of fun with this.
Yes.
Okay, he takes a train home, to Delaware, which some people think is a part, with apologies to our listeners in Delaware, is a part of D.C. They are still trying to brand him as the guy who might have come from Scranton at one point, but he now wears those beautiful silver ties, and, you know, the cufflinks are sterling, and he is, you know, the senator, with all that brings.
Look, you know, if you hang around Washington long enough, you can tell the difference between someone who has kind of absorbed the sense of privilege of the place and someone who hasn't. Joe Biden can talk to anybody. I mean, that moniker, Lunch Pail Joe, is fairly accurate. Amtrak people love him. You know, I've talked to them about that. I think he'll be able to do pretty well carrying credentials as someone who understands what a normal life looks like, especially coming out of Scranton. He's going to talk more about Scranton than he does about Delaware.
Well, and that's the hope that, and being Catholic, he might appeal to working class Catholics as
that's
well.
Right.
But he's a supporter of legalized abortion, which may not go over well with that quarter. On the other hand, he voted in 2002 for the war in Iraq, and so there you lose the code pink branch of the party.
Well, here's his problem. Here's someone who has cast more votes than almost anyone in public life, all of which can be scrutinized. But he's also someone with a capacity to explain votes and to reach people. On abortion, for example, he talks about the fact that he, although he personally opposes abortion, does not think that the government ought to tell women what to do. At the same time, he opposes federally funding abortion, which is a distinction that may not mean a lot to many people, but it does to some of the critical groups we're talking about.
Well, Mitt Romney, who may be the VP pick for the Republicans, is in town. We want to talk, first of all, about why he's here in Denver. But let's listen to what he said. He strode right up to all the press yesterday and held a press conference. Let's listen to a little of his thoughts about Biden and Obama.
But if you look at Joe Biden's record, with some 30 years in foreign policy experience, there's about 30 years of generally being wrong on foreign policy issues.
Excuse me, that's former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney speaking just on Joe Biden. You can see he's going to be going, down that track. But we want to ask you, I mean, we know there's usually party operatives at attending the opposite convention. But how unusual is this, that there is a war room here and there's a potential VP strolling into the press center holding a press conference? This is historic, isn't it?
Well, think of this as political Olympics. Every year, runners can run faster. Why? Because there's a precedent from the year before and you just push harder. The war room idea is like political Olympics. It gets tougher and harder every year. This year is especially interesting because it looks to me like a kind of tryout for the Republican vice presidential nomination. You have Rudy Giuliani here, Carly Fiorina, who's economic advisor to McCain, and, of course, Mitt Romney. And they're trying out their credentials as vice presidential attack dog. That's kind of the new role of the vice president. You don't just go to funerals. You also are the one that takes all the hard hits and the incoming flak.
So just in the few seconds we have, what do you expect to hear from Biden tonight?
I think that there will be tears in the eyes tonight. I think Biden is going to pick up the theme that all the Democratic top speakers have. This, I'm an American. This is an American life. We're living in an American dream, semicolon. But there's a danger that that dream is ending. And all of the major speeches can be subsumed by that template.
And so the attack dog part might wait.
Oh, I think you'll see some flashes of it, but basically he's establishing his credentials as someone who understands everyday Americans.
Gail Chaddick from the Christian Science Monitor, as always, we love your insight, and thank you for being here with us at the Pepsi Center in Denver. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we have a conversation with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, a civil rights leader who is going to see the dream that she started working on in her 20s 45 years ago come to fruition when Obama is nominated. So be here for that tomorrow as well. You're listening to Here and Now.
So here's what we're going to ask you to do. Basically, you're going to say your name and where you're from. And then, very simply, I nominate Barack Obama because, fill in the blank, whatever it is, whatever reasons you have for supporting him. Ready? 3, 2.
Action. YouTube crews are taping Democratic delegates, volunteers, and staff, anyone who walks by their booth around the corner from us here on the second floor of the Pepsi Center. This is the first presidential convention for YouTube. You remember it didn't even exist during the 2004 elections. And now YouTube claims to be a political player, giving anyone who wants it camera time.
1, 2, 3, 4. Obama.
Yeah, he's the man.
Obama.
He's got the ill health plan.
Obama. Y'all make some noise. Obama. He's from Illinois.
Obama. American International.
Obama.
Yeah, his plans are so rational.
Obama. Because he's younger and wiser. Obama. Community organizer. Obama. Wouldn't it be great? Obama. In 2008.
John Wesley from Vermont, Chaz Davis from Minnesota, two 20-somethings who got into politics through the Howard Dean campaign 4 years ago and stayed. They're here this week, and now they're on YouTube. YouTube has a crew of videographers, interviewers, and staff at the DNC. They plan to do the same at the GOP convention next week in Minneapolis. Steve Grove is head of news and politics at YouTube. He says YouTube provides the platform, people provide the message.
I want to give everyone who's here a chance to get their videos up onto YouTube and tell the rest of the world what's taking place here in Denver.
The younger generation, you know, is being called the YouTube generation. You're not just a company anymore. I mean, you're a whole generation. Others have said what the role of YouTube has been in this race. What do you think it's been?
We think it's brought a lot more transparency to the political process. These days, anything that anybody says essentially ends up online.
And I'm thinking of Obama Girl.
Yeah. Obama Girl has played a role, I think, gotten people excited and thinking that in some ways politics is sexy again, I think. But also I think it's given citizens a chance to hold their politicians accountable for what they say. Back in the 2006 midterm elections, George Allen was famously caught using a racial slur that essentially ended his Senate race in Virginia. That was really the birth of YouTube politics. And since then, we see these quote-unquote gotcha videos on the site almost every week. Senators falling asleep at meetings.
Does it also in some ways maybe demean politics? If suddenly everybody's cell phone video of somebody burping ends up on YouTube and it blows things perhaps larger than they should be and gives people no privacy and doesn't allow our leaders to have flaws.
Well, I think that's a good criticism. However, I do think that there's a new kind of expectation on the internet today, and people know what they're getting online, and they don't expect people to be perfect. In some ways, if we can humanize our politicians a little bit, all the more the better. You know, it actually gives politicians the chance to pull back the political veneer a bit and seem more human and actually have what we think is a bit more of an authentic dialogue. You know, there's no media middleman to sort of communicate one message to the other. It's just politicians straight to voters, voters straight to politicians.
Do you worry about, though, being co-opted? We hear about Madison Avenue firms making videos, getting them on YouTube, yeah. And people think that they're authentic, and they're not.
Yeah, I mean, it's up to our users to decide what they think is authentic and what they think isn't. I think if the content's enjoyable.
But if they don't know? I mean, I'm thinking of the cell phone that was supposed to make popcorn pop, and turned out that it was a company that was actually trying to show off their Bluetooth technology. Campaigns are accused of doing it, putting on what are supposed to be authentic things, but they're not. They're highly crafted campaign work.
Well, I think the counter to that is really that there's the effect of the wisdom of crowds online. So when you have that many more people watching content, vetting content, you actually give the people on the internet the chance to determine what's true and what's not. And I think actually the fact that so many more people are creating content now holds journalists to a higher standard to say, look, you have to get this story right, because if you don't, somebody else will.
You're putting everybody in front of the camera over there. Age is not a consideration. But what are you hearing from young people in particular?
From young people in particular, we're hearing, I think, very similar concerns to what the rest of the nation is, and that's the economy. Are there going to be jobs in the future? How are they going to pay for college? How are they going to pay for gas to get to their job?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for coming by.
Steve Grove, head of news and politics at YouTube. By the way, the Rocky Mountain News voted the Obama girl, Amber Lee Ettinger, the most stalked Obama in Denver this week. She, of course, achieved fame with the famous viral YouTube video Crush on Obama, where she sings his praises. Up next, we go to the movies, Here and Now.
I was just watching you on C-SPAN. Anyway, call me back.
You seem to float onto the floor. Democratic Convention 2004.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
I'm Robin Young in Denver. It's Here and Now. Most people go to the movies to escape the daily grind of news, but if you just can't get enough of this exciting and sometimes nasty political campaign, you could rent a good movie about exciting and nasty political campaigns. Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr has some recommendations. Ty, first, what makes political campaigns such fodder for films?
They pull the curtain away from a process that we inherently know stinks. The movies are about finding the idealism. They give you all the lies, all the nastiness, and then they say, this guy means it.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, let's start with a classic. You recommend Preston Sturges' 1940 film, The Great McGinty.
Oh, well, Preston Sturges was one of the great writer-directors of early Hollywood. And this is actually one of the more cynical movies about the electoral process. It's about a bum who becomes governor of New York. Brian Donlevy plays a depression homeless guy who votes about 10 times in one election because he gets, you know, a free piece of bread every time he does. So he comes to the attention of the party boss, played by Akeem Tamarov, and they realize that, you know, he looks good, that he's a patsy, and so election by election he ends up in the governor's mansion of, well, the state is not said, but it's clearly New York. And then to his horrible discredit, falls in love with the secretary and becomes a nice guy. But for most of the movie, it's this hilariously cynical take on what it takes to get ahead in politics in America. And it really holds up beautifully.
You'll have to kiss a lot of babies, squeeze a lot of meats, wear your old clothes. They don't want no dudes after Tillinghast. I'll tell Jarvis about it. Oh, another thing. You gotta get married right away.
What do you mean, get married right away?
What do you think it means? Women got the vote now. Maybe you didn't hear about it. They don't like bachelors.
A scene from The Great McGinty from Preston Sturges in 1940. And by the way, we're going to have Ty Burr's whole list at our website, here-now.org. Let's move on to Frank Capra, of course, a director that people think about when they think about Americana, It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But you're recommending a less-known film, State of the Union.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is the movie that you should see if you want to buy or rebuy into all those noble, wonderful ideals about our electoral process. State of the Union is a post-war film from Capra. It's much less hopeful, although it ends, because it's Capra, he has to end well. He can only take his cynicism so far. Spencer Tracy plays a big businessman who's running for president. He's separated from his wife, Katharine Hepburn, and he's having an affair with a newspaper woman played by Angela Lansbury, a young and very devious Angela Lansbury.
Well, let's listen to a scene from State of the Union with Angela Lansbury. Here she is with Adolphe Manjou, who plays a political power broker who doesn't understand why she's helping Spencer Tracy's character run for president.
You know, I know about your father and the Republican Party.
You also know that they've given me the beautiful brush off ever since. On occasions, they've even seen fit to describe the support of my newspapers as the kiss of death. Well, I thought if I could present the country and the Republican Party with the next president of the United States, it would give me more than a little pleasure to see certain heads roll.
It's a movie about what you have to give up if you want to become president. You know, and that's what a lot of these election movies are about. What do you have to give up if you want to get there and do the things you want to do? And because it's Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn's on the sidelines, you know, urging him to do what's right, we kind of know where it's going. But it's great fun seeing, you know, where it goes.
Okay. Robert Altman makes a couple of appearances on your list. First for the 1975 film Nashville. You know, people think country music. No, you say politics.
Oh, absolutely. This is a movie made in 1975. Nixon had left office. Everything seemed up in the air. The 1976 presidential election was gearing up. And this is a movie that said entertainment is politics and politics is entertainment. It was one of the first to really articulate that directly. And yes, it's set in Nashville. It's about the country music industry. But weaving throughout the entire film is a candidate's van for Hal Philip Walker of the Replacement Party. You never see him. You only hear his voice on this van.
There is no question about being involved. The question is what to do. It is the very nature of government to strain at a gnat and swallow a camel.
Various characters in the movie are for him, they're against him, but that van sets a political line throughout the entire movie that eventually pays off when one of the characters pulls out a gun and shoots one of the performers, and it's a political assassination. The movie frames it as a political assassination, and in the context of the movie, given everything that we know in 1975 that has happened from JFK's assassination up until that moment, it becomes this immense American tragedy in which politics and entertainment just come together and nothing seems to work. It's a really daring movie that really holds up quite well.
Okay, that's Nashville from Robert Altman. But another Altman work is Tanner 88. This was the HBO series in 1988. It was written by Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist, and followed another politician running for president, one of the first that uses actual political figures playing themselves.
Right. And that's something we see in a lot of movies now. Tanner 88 is sort of where it started. And this is one of the great works of political satire in American entertainment history. People don't really remember it because it was a TV series and it was a cable series back when HBO wasn't really known for doing that sort of thing. But it's out there on DVD. It still stings.
March 11th, 1988. I've spent the day talking with contributors. Even after a year of such calls, it still amazes me how many ordinary citizens feel strongly enough about an election's outcome to give. Their faith lends much dignity to the whole process by which we choose our countries.
Dad, USA Today is on the other line. They want to know, if you were a fruit or a vegetable, which one would you be?
Okay. Well, we've talked a lot about films with people running for office. You also picked the 1993 comedy Dave, starring Kevin Kline, as Dave Kovic, a man who makes a living impersonating President William Mitchell, and of course is pulled into the White House to impersonate the president.
Right. This is not about an election. It's about a sitting president. Well, in this case, actually a comatose president, because the president actually goes into a coma and the average guy who looks just like him has to end up impersonating him and actually turns out to be a better president and a better husband and a nicer guy than the nasty guy we elected. This, to my mind, is one of the more successful Capra-esque political films that has come out in the last 20 years. Everybody tries to make a good, feel-good, incisive Capra movie. That's the model. You know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is sort of the model. Dave is one I think that works, partially because you've got a great actor, Kevin Kline, portraying both a very, very nasty but effective president and also a regular guy. What would happen if you got into the White House? What would you do? That's what the movie's basically asking.
From today, I'm going to make it the responsibility of this government find a job for every American who wants one.
A scene from Dave on Boston Globe critic Ty Burr's list of great political films. The American President is on the list, Wag the Dog, Election. We'll have the whole list, as we said, at our website, here-now.org. But Ty, one last question. Do you think conservatives have a point? We've talked about this, that conservative presidents don't get represented in Hollywood movies in a good light. You know, that we see politics and the president and campaigns through the prism of liberal Hollywood.
I think you can take that too far, but I think there is some truth in it. I think the people who run Hollywood now, the executives and the directors, they all came of age in the 60s and 70s at a time when Hollywood was making movies that were really groundbreaking and different and dark. And so, yes, they are presenting movies that present their way of seeing the world. I also do think that there are some conservative movies that have been made. We've talked about this before, usually featuring, you know, lone heroes, but they don't directly address conservative presidents or the conservative side of the election process. When you think of the presidents who've had biopics made of them, you know, there's Woodrow Wilson, lots of Abraham Lincoln, Truman, Gary Sinise playing Truman, you know, JFK's all over the place. Oliver Stone did do Nixon.
And he's about to do Bush.
And he's about to do Bush, although not, I think, as the right would want to see him.
Ty Burr, with films you might want to rent this political season. Ty, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.